From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Georgia gubernatorial campaigns say education is a top priority. Among the goals on Stacey Abrams' platform, wraparound services. GPB's Grant Blankenship reports on what an expansion of these services could mean for students.
Years ago, when Lee Colburn was principal at Marietta High School in Cobb County, she thought her students were getting what they needed.
So we were providing tutoring and summer school and intersessions, and that's all important. But kids were talking about difficulties with poverty, mental health, immigration, addiction, transiency.
All things, she says, were outside her expertise, but all things that could keep a kid from learning. Colburn kept listening until she was convinced that what her school needed were outside experts. That would eventually inform the exhaustive list of resources of what became the Marietta Success Center, next door to the high school.
A clothing pantry with a laundromat, a food pantry, pantry for school supplies.
We had all kinds of toiletries and things.
Measuring the success of efforts like this is tough because they do offer so many things. Still, most studies of wraparound services suggest they are a net benefit to students. Today, 3 years later, Colburn has her own private consulting business and has helped other wraparound service centers get up and running, but mostly in Atlanta and North Georgia. But the other two-thirds of the state want this, too, which is why Colburn and her business partner, Linda Beggs, are training 16 educators in an old school building with stained wood and that old school smell. It's halfway between Macon and Augusta in the town of Tennell.
Moving away from the random acts of good intention to the interconnected.
Each of these educators has been assigned their own 10-county chunk of the state where they will be trying to launch wraparound services. Their salaries take up all the money the State Department of Education had to put toward this pilot project. Former Pulaski County Superintendent Jenna Sparrow is one of the trainees. She's charged with looking after a set of counties 50 miles south of Macon. She says this is great, but she has one big question.
Who's going to pay for this? Where's this money coming from?
Because services cost money, right? Lee Colburn says not necessarily. The idea is to look at the businesses, nonprofits, and charities in your town and tell them what your students say they need. Then the services just come. All it costs is time.
I linked a lot of arms. I didn't twist arms.
But she did it tirelessly until it was obvious it was a full-time job. So Colburn hired an arm linker for $115,000 in total compensation.
First year we had $1.7 million in services.
That's a 10-time return on the investment. Still, Janice Sparrow says for a rural district, even that seed money could be out of reach.
In the smaller systems, sometimes you've kind of maxed out.
Another issue. Go to a small town in Georgia and you're likely to find two high schools. One public, one private. One black, one white. And that complicates the job of putting resources together for educators like Shonda Green, who represent counties in southwest Georgia.
What's your elevator pitch to them?
How it's not an isolated issue to just one population of the community, but it becomes a complete community issue.
Democratic gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams wants to set aside funds for wraparound services as a part of a larger revamping of the state's school funding formula. Her aim of ending the state's private school scholarship program would also free up $100 million for that cause. Meanwhile, the educators and Lee Colburn's training have their work cut out for them. Up next, they will conduct surveys to see how well their corners of the state can meet student needs with what they have at hand. For GPB News, I'm Grant Blankenship in Macon.
And Grant joins us now to discuss how candidates propose changing Georgia's education system. Grant, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So before we get to their respective plans of the candidates, let's talk about the core of your story in this wraparound school services. We heard some of the educators talk about the challenges of getting funding, especially in rural areas. So what is the current thinking about funding these services as compared to textbooks or math teachers?
Well, yeah, I mean, clearly traditional academics still have to be funded. Nobody's talking about, you know, taking money from the math department for an on-site laundry. But it's in rural districts where this philanthropic money in North Georgia is sort of thick. In rural districts in South Georgia, it's not. And so there is this question of exactly how we're going to pay for this stuff in places outside of Atlanta. And that's where the idea of state support for wraparound might come in.
And of course, that comes from the state funding comes from the directive of the governor in many cases. The candidates for governor do agree on some things in terms of education, not on others. Where do wraparound services fit into Democrat Stacey Abrams' education platform?
Well, so you may remember hearing in the news last year or in the last year or so that the state formula for funding schools was only fully funded for the first time ever in like 30 years. Mm-hmm. That formula came together in the 1980s. No one was thinking about wraparound services when they came up with that formula. So Abrams has said she wants a new school funding formula for the state that does take wraparound services into account. I asked the Brian Kemp campaign for a couple of weeks about their stance on wraparound services, and I was never really successful in hearing back from them. So I'm not sure what he thinks about this issue.
Abrams has declared, I want to be Georgia's public education governor and to fund wraparound services by ending the state's private school scholarship program, or SSO. Kemp said that he would expand it. First of all, how much money are we talking about?
Well, so that's $100 million now. Kemp wants to make that a $200 million ceiling. And this is money that comes from you and I, from people who choose to put their money into these funds. In return, you would get a dollar-for-dollar rebate on your state income taxes. So this program is sort of in opposition to the wraparound services thing. It's almost like a top-down version of helping students get what they want versus sort of the ground-up version that wraparound presents.
Well, so these tax credits help thousands of children attend private schools, correct? By allowing donors to pledge to an organization providing scholarships, right?
Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah, when you put your money into the program, you get to say, this is the school I want the money to go to. And the problem is, we really don't know, and because of state law, we don't know who the children are who are getting these scholarships. We don't know who they are demographically, economically, and maybe even more crucially, we don't know what they're doing academically. We don't know if they're benefiting from this private school education in a way that they weren't in public school. And again, that's because state law says the private schools don't have to report any of that.
This isn't the first time that the private schools, this SSO program has come up. Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle was secretly recorded earlier this year. He was criticizing a bill to raise the cap on tax credits for private school scholarships, admitting that he had to for political reasons. So let's hear. Opponents of expanded private schools question their effectiveness. Here is educational policy analyst Stephen Owens.
We know the scholarship granting organizations, we know the total dollar amount given to those organizations. Beyond that, we don't know what students took advantage of these. We don't know if they come from high-income background, low-income background, where they went to school, how they did at those schools, or anything.
So no assessments, as you mentioned, and Stephen Owens capitalized on just there. So how do you know when you take how much money from a family that goes to a school without private school students performing? Do we know if they're performing any better than public school students?
Well, so Ben Scafidi is an economist at Kennesaw State University who has written a lot about this. And he would tell you that we're framing this question in completely the wrong way. It's not about how students are doing academically when they go to these schools. It's whether or not parents who are taking advantage of the scholarships feel like they're getting what they want. And the onus is on them to decide if this is money well spent. So basically, you're left with common sense and the faith you have in the private school that it's doing what you want it to do. That being said, there are two studies out there that give us some glimpse of what might be going on. So from the University of Virginia, they looked at private schools to see if they did give kids a better education. And when you control for income, that is to say, when you bring the wealthy kids down to the same sort of level statistically with non-wealthy kids, it doesn't look like private schools do a better job. That was what the University of Virginia found. And then over in Alabama, the state legislature requires an academic vetting of their scholarship program. And so at the University of Alabama, economists looked at their scholarship program and found that, sure, low-income kids from public schools, when they go to private schools, they get close to the state averages on ACT test scores. That's the test you take, one of the tests you take to get into college. They get close to state averages but don't exceed it. So in Alabama, they kind of felt like it was a wash. It didn't hurt, but it didn't help a whole lot.
So that's counterintuitive in some ways. We tend to think that the private schools are much better because if schools are for-profit ventures, their financial incentives might make them perform better. It sounds like there's not a lot of evidence of that.
Yeah, I don't even know. These schools aren't for-profit ventures as such, but they are free market actors, right? I mean, they take in money and they ask for money and people either choose to pay it or not. So they're at the whims of the customers. I mean, they are meant to be responsive to the parents who send their kids there. And that's sort of the argument for these school choice scholarship programs. Be responsive to what parents say they want for their kids in terms of education. And that responsiveness is, for the proponents of this, the ultimate measure of how effective this program is.
We're getting a read of the respective gubernatorial candidates' education platforms with GPB reporter Grant Blankenship. Grant, do you get a sense of how pivotal an issue this is for voters?
You know, I wish I could get in the minds of everyone at my whim, but I don't know. I know for educators, this is a big, big issue, and I don't think that many public school educators are lining up behind the scholarship program. But as for what parents and just citizens think, it's hard to say. It must be a big issue if it's out front for both campaigns, however.
Yeah, and are both of them putting it in the front platform of their campaigns?
Well, I would be remiss if I didn't remind everyone that the other big education issue for Brian Kemp was this $5,000 raise for every teacher in the state to the tune of $600 million. So his issues are twained that way. But yeah, for Stacey Abrams, this wraparound services thing and this equity in education issue is very much out in front and sort of tip of the spear for what she's telling the state.
Oh, Grant, I would be remiss to not ask you about the reporting that you've done on the ground in Albany and other affected areas by Hurricane Michael or Tropical Storm Michael when it hit there. People struggling for basic needs. Heard a story that you did this morning for infant formula, for example. Is assistance now making its way?
Yeah, I mean, they're being very systemic. I was in Doherty County, Albany, yesterday, and they are being very systemic there in helping people find food. And the thing about that community is they're well practiced in this. They were hit by two tornadoes last year within a month of each other. And so they had infrastructure in like sort of ad hoc community-based infrastructure, neighbors taking care of each other. They had that to just sort of slide into place again when this hit last week. And that's definitely happening there. That being said, there's like 30,000 people in Albany alone who are still having a hard time getting food. So it's going to be a while.
How about power and cell phone service, which I know in some affected areas is not working? How is it working in there in Doherty County?
Power is not back on yet. As of yesterday, there were still 13,000 customers in the immediate Albany area that were without power. Officials say it could be up to 5 days before that's all back on. And, of course, that affects how people can store food. Even if you can get food, a lot of it's going to, the good food, the nourishing food, will largely be perishable. And so people are saying, well, even if I can get meat, where am I going to put it? So.
Well, GPB reporter Grant Blankenship, we will keep listening for your reports. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So coming up, we're going to survey the agricultural damage wrought by Hurricane Michael and check in with how farmers in southeast and southwest Georgia are coping with the loss of crops and their main source of income. This is On Second Thought.